Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is podcast number 113 for Monday, March 5th, 2012. And I missed Friday? I believe I missed Friday because of all the family problems that were going on. Anyway, let's get right into it today, shall we? The other day I heard a greenbacker talking about bitcoins. Now, I'm no expert on bitcoins, and I'd actually like to know more about bitcoins. I've tried to have set up a thing for bitcoins on badquaker.com website before, and it really didn't work out, and I would like to get back into that and get it back on there again. And I'd like to know more about bitcoins and do more with them. But I have looked at it a little bit, and I've researched it a little bit. And this greenbacker friend of mine was talking about bitcoins and how they're a perfect example of a fiat currency that that works. And he was using that as an example as to why the greenbacker idea will work. And, well, hey, let me just cover a couple things. First off, the essence of the greenbacker is not necessarily fiat money, because there are various different ways of having fiat money without having the essence of what the greenbacker must have for their theory to work. And that is, Congress controls the issuing of the greenbacks. That's the essence of the greenbacker. I wanted to say theology, but yeah, almost. That's the essence of their doctrine, is that Congress control the issuing of the fiat currency, and that's what the greenbacker pushes. And their purpose in that is they intend to say that by doing this, then the government won't have to tax us, because it can just print up the money it wants to spend. Of course, this is a horrible misunderstanding of a variety of things. First off, the understanding that when the government prints up money, or whoever, anytime anybody creates more money uncontrollably like that, and, well, we'll get into uncontrollably in a minute, but whenever anyone is dumping large quantities of money into a money system, what you're doing is devaluing the money that's already there. So in essence, that is a tax. Now, whether the government taxes you outright through a sales tax, or through an import tax or an export tax or shipping taxes, or through excise taxes of any kind, or through income taxes, it doesn't matter how the government taxes you. The point is, they are taxing you. The point is, they are taking your wealth. Now, the difference in a fiat, issued money, as opposed to any other kind of money, is when the government issues mass amounts of that fiat money, the government is taxing you without your control and without your knowledge. So by saying, well, if we have a greenback, the perfect greenback world, then Congress won't have to tax you. Yes, it will. It will tax you every single time it issues more greenbacks. And that's the problem, because it's invisible to the average person. The average person will have no idea how much they're being taxed, because they're being taxed through inflation. Now, that's still a tax. And it's exactly what the Federal Reserve does today. We get taxed through inflation every time the Federal Reserve issues a new batch of money. The difference is, for the greenbacker wants Congress to control that rather than the Federal Reserve. Because Congress, why, has such a good reputation of self-control? Oh, but they say, but there'll be a constitutional amendment to restrict how much Congress can issue. Yeah, like that's ever stopped Congress in the past. How long have we been playing this game? And how long has Congress ever been restricted by the Constitution? This is going into the world of fantasy, believing that Congress can be restricted by the Constitution, when it never has up to this point. What magically is going to change in Congress so that all of a sudden they're going to start obeying the Constitution? But either way, the entire premise of the greenback is based on a faith in this group of human beings who are selected out from the rest of us. And the idea that no matter what happens with the rest of the population, those guys will be good. Those guys will follow the Constitution. Those guys will never cheat and never just randomly increase the budget every single time they want. Oh, they would never do that, right? They would never just raise the ceiling, right? They wouldn't do that, right? Now that's faith. That is blind faith. And now let's take this to anarcho-capitalism for a minute. The same friend of mine who was talking about first let me back up. First off, Bitcoins are not fiat in the sense that a greenbacker sees fiat money issued through Congress. There's actually restrictions that are built into the system with Bitcoins. Each and every Bitcoin has to be mined, and that's part of the process. Now that's a virtual mining that takes place, but that there is no central body issuing Bitcoins. There is no central government controlling the issuance of Bitcoins. Now that's exactly what you have when you have government controlling a fiat currency. You have the central planning of the monetary supply. That's socialism. That is exactly what socialism is. When you have central planning of the money supply, you have socialism. Everything else is just icing on the cake. Central planning of the financial system, of the money supply, that's central to socialism. But Bitcoins don't have that. Bitcoin is decentralized. There is no central body that controls how many Bitcoins are in circulation. Bitcoins are created through the mining process by thousands or perhaps at some point millions of individual miners creating them. Now that is not central planning, and that's the difference between Bitcoins and a fiat coin or a fiat money controlled by Congress. The difference is socialism. Now that's not difficult to figure out. Central planning equals socialism. Congress controlled money equals socialism. You don't believe me? Read Marx. He's the one that said it first. Now let's go to this idea that we can trust government somehow. The same person who will tell me that Congress needs to control the money supply will also say that, well, your ideas of anarchism are naive. You just believe that people are going to be good. You just want to trust people. You think all people are going to be good if there's no government. No, I don't believe anything like that. And I don't know of any anarchist that does believe that. I've read a lot of material, and I've never read any anarchist that said that. That's a straw man argument. And it's a quite silly one, actually. The fact is, the anarchist looks at the situation and says, there's no one who should have the authority to rule over me, and there's no one that I can trust with the authority to rule over me. I am the only one that I can trust to make choices that are in my best interest. Now, will there be bad people? Yes, there will be bad people. Are there bad people? Yes, there are bad people. But under your governmental form of hierarchy, where a state is used, where there's a monopoly of aggression, what you're actually doing is you're deciding that a small group of human beings can be trusted with a monopoly of aggression. And you give them the authority to act in a way that no one else in society can act. And you think that somehow those people are going to be good. You can't trust society. You can't trust all the other human beings to be good because you've decided in your mind that human beings in general are bad. But somehow selecting one group of human beings and giving them rights and powers and authority that nobody else has, you can trust them. You can't trust yourself. You can't trust your neighbor. You can't trust the guy down the street. But if you put a uniform on a guy with a little badge, or you give a person a title like Your Honor or Judge or Supreme Court or President or Senator or Congress, you give them a title like that and the authority to use violence in any way that they want, and somehow they're going to be good. Now that's naive. That's blind faith. That's leaping out, assuming that there's this magical group of people in society who are much better than the rest of us, and they can use violence and aggression in a kind and gentle way, and they can guide society. But you can't. You're not smart enough. You're not good enough. You're not calm enough. You can't be trusted with the authority to run your own life. We have to put that authority in somebody else's life. And then we say, oh, well, we can't trust government. We have to write a constitution. So you're going to trust them. A, you're going to trust them to write the constitution. B, you're going to trust them to follow the constitution. And what are you going to do when they don't? Because in the U.S., here in America, in the U.S., they break that constitution thousands of times a year, and they have since it was written. So what's your solution to that? Well, I know the solution to that. The person with the faith in the government just ignores it when they break the constitution and repeats the same mantra over and over. I can't trust my neighbor, but I can trust Congress. I can't trust my neighbor, but I can trust Congress. What do you think's going to keep a person honest on the street, walking down the street? People behaving, people are doing everything normal. Everything in society is just like it is today, except there's no cops. There's no government. There's no grand authority. What's going to keep people from, say, just running up and robbing you? Well, if individuals were not taken away, if individuals didn't have all their rights stripped away, and if individuals could arm themselves in any way that they felt comfortable arming themselves, and that includes pretty much, well, anything that a person feels that they need to carry or any person they need to hire to protect them, if all those things were allowed, how many robbers do you really think would have the guts to just randomly rob people or randomly break into homes or randomly run into a school and start shooting? If everybody, you know, and it's amazing to me too, because some of the right-wing conservative type people who tell me that the government, that people can't be trusted without having a government here, those same people, and again, a government based on the state, based on the monopoly of aggression, those same people who believe that human beings can't be trusted and that we need the police force, those same people will tell you that if everybody in, say, a particular university had been armed, or if a good portion of them had been armed, then a shooting wouldn't take place because somebody would have taken that person out. That same person who makes that argument tells me that I'm not safe in my own home without the police because somebody will break my door down and come in. I don't see the leap in logic here. Well, there is no logic. It's blind faith. That's all it is. It's blind faith in the state. It's the worshiping of a god, a faceless god that is the state. That's all it is. It's placing your faith in a belief, in a magical thing that doesn't exist, because there really is no state. As I've said a million times over and over and over, there is no state. There are only people who believe in the state, and they act on those beliefs. And when people stop believing in the state, there will be no state. But even today, when people believe in the state, for you to believe that their acts are only going to be good and benevolent acts, display your lack of faith in anything else, such as humans, or such as whatever created humans. You have a lack of faith in what created humans, and you have an abundance of faith in a small group of human beings who want authority and want to be lords over you and will use the mythology of the state to control and manipulate you. And so that two-thirds or three-quarters of your wealth, of your income, of the sweat of your brow goes to support them because of your faith in them. No priest would be so bold. Most religions throughout the ages have only taken somewhere roughly 10, maybe more percent, but roughly, usually around 10%. Priests of any religion rarely try to take more than that from their flock, and almost always it's voluntary. But this religion of the state seeks to take 60, 70, 80% of your income, and you willingly give it up because of your blind faith. Your blind faith that the government will somehow restrict itself, that the government will only issue the money they really, really need, that the government will behave itself and follow the Constitution that it wrote. They never have before, but you've got the faith, don't you? Now let's just think about human nature for a minute. You know, talking about whether or not humans can be trusted. The first thing is that we have to deal with is a misunderstanding about the basis of human nature. The anarchist doesn't say that humans are inherently good, therefore we can trust them. Just the opposite. The anarchist says we can't trust humans. Not because the humans are good or the humans are bad, but the anarchist understands that humans tend to make the decisions and take the actions that they believe are best, are in their best interest. Now, they may not always be right, but humans tend to want to do whatever it is that's best for themselves, not what's best for somebody else. And in doing this, oftentimes a good human will do something that another human perceives as bad because it's not in their interest. It's in the original person's interest. So, okay, so like person A and person B. Person A says, oh, it's in my best interest to pick this apple and eat it. But person B, who believes he owns the apple, doesn't see that in the best interest of person B. You just took my apple. You see? So the anarchist understands that people tend to do that which they perceive as being in their best interest. So then the anarchist understands that if we set up a series of rules that respect each other's property rights, then we can achieve a situation where we all can do that which is best in our own interest, and that also makes it the best for all of us together. Now the anarchist understands that. The statist only believes that since humans are bad, again, we have to take faith and we have to believe that we can hire a group or appoint a group of humans who will somehow be good and control the whole rest of us. And of course, that's pretty silly. So then what causes a person to do things that we consider bad? Well, let's consider the case of Willie Sutton. Willie Sutton is a good example because he's often misquoted, and he even allowed the misquote and made money off the misquote. But Willie Sutton was the bank robber from back in the 1930s, and he was the one originally accredited with the phrase where a reporter asked him, "Willie, why do you keep robbing banks?" And he responded with, "Because that's where they keep the money." In his later years, Willie actually admitted that that was just a made-up thing that a reporter did to sell stories, that he never actually said that. But Willie admitted that he allowed that myth to go on because, you know, he got notoriety from it, and he actually made money off of the phrase. He actually wrote a book with a similar phrase. And so he, you know, he was willing to go along with the ruse in order to fill his own pockets. But Willie said the real reason that he robbed banks, the side reason was for the money, and the reason he started was for the money. But the real reason he continued to rob banks was because of the thrill. Now, this brings about a misunderstanding that some people have about crime. A lot of really naive people, especially on the right-wing or conservative people, have a tendency to fall into this trap. They think, ooh, there are bad people out there doing bad things. Like the guy robbing the liquor store is robbing the liquor store because he's bad. Or the drug dealer dealing drugs is doing that. He's dealing those drugs because he's bad. Or the person doing any particular thing in society that the right winger has decided is evil, he's doing it because he's evil. Well, that's silly. That's just silly. The person robbing the bank typically is robbing the bank because he wants money, because he's making a choice to do something that he believes will be in his best interest. If he was walking into a bank that he knew where everybody in there was fully armed and that he wouldn't have a chance, he wouldn't rob that bank. The mugger who stops to rob a purse from an old lady, he's not doing that because he's evil or because he's bad. He's doing that because he thinks he is making a decision that is in his best interest. Now, his thinking may be flawed, and he may lack morals, and he may be making a choice that we look at as evil or as bad. But ultimately, his decision is because it's based on what he perceives as being best for himself. And that's the same as anybody else whenever they make a decision. If one person makes a decision, the best thing in his best interest, the best thing for him to do is wake up in the morning and go to work. Well, that's a decision based upon the morals that he possesses. And another person wakes up in the morning and they say, you know what, I think I'll go knock off a liquor store today and get some cash. He's doing that. Sure, his decision is altered by his morals. But ultimately, the decision to rob the liquor store is based on the idea that he's going to do that which is in his best interest to do. Now, there is, like in the Willie Sutton example, there is a level of thrill. But again, this is just doing what a person perceives as being in their best interest. So, for example, in Willie Sutton's case, he said he got a thrill out of robbing banks. But then again, isn't that why people stand in line for roller coasters? Because they want that thrill. So Willie Sutton got a thrill by teasing death by robbing banks. But Willie Sutton always knew that he wouldn't actually get killed in robbing the banks, because he was very good at what he did, and he was good at controlling the room and coming in with authority and power, and he knew that nobody in there would be armed, or anybody that would be armed would be very limited, and he knew he could control the room. Well, that's exactly like a person who decides to ride a roller coaster, or drive a car super fast, or take any other risk that they feel that they can control the risk and yet get the thrill of an almost death experience. So even when you have a person who's doing something we believe to be immoral for pure thrill, they're still doing it thinking they are doing that which is in their own best interest. Because if they really thought they would die, they probably wouldn't do it. Now, the very small segment of the population who's crazy and will do things anyway because either they're trying to commit suicide or they're trying to do some, you know, some aspect of their personality is broken. Well, you know, guess what? Even with the state present, those people do what they do. So having the state doesn't keep the crazy person from doing crazy things. Having the state only robs 70% of your wealth to pay for a bloated bureaucracy that sits around and waits for that guy to do something crazy, and then they go out and clean up the mess. But couldn't we just hire somebody to do that at a lower wage and allow the market to decide what the wage of, here's an example. Now, the other day, on the freeway that's near my house, in the middle of the night, this is probably, I think they said around 3 o'clock in the morning or so, a group of young men needed to get across the freeway. They were all on foot. So rather than, okay, now let me set this stage a little bit better. In this particular section of the freeway has a very large, big Y, where one part of the freeway goes north and the other part of the freeway slowly splits off and goes east. Now, if you, and I haven't actually done the measurements, but this should be fairly accurate. If you go from point to point to point of where a pedestrian can legally cross the freeway, you have probably, in that freeway section, you probably have about 15 miles in that three-legged Y of that freeway system. You probably have about 15 miles of freeway where there's no way for a pedestrian to legally get from one side to the other. Within that, there are a couple of ways that a pedestrian can do it. But if you just count the distance from overpass to overpass and in the complex of this big, huge freeway Y, there's about 15, let's say 12 to 15 miles that you cannot cross the freeway as a pedestrian. And within the body of that Y in the freeway lies three major shopping mall type areas, one actual mall and two other like strip mall type, but huge strip malls, including a super Walmart, a big Target store, a bunch of other that kind of shopping type businesses, and a huge auto two auto malls that are in that segment. Now, in addition to all that, there's a number of bars. There are dozens of restaurants. There's a variety of hotels and motels. There's all kinds of entertainment, including late night and adult organizations, all within the body of this Y, surrounded within an area where, like I say, there's as much as 12 to 15 miles where you can't get out of that Y if you're a pedestrian without crossing the freeway illegally. And so at 3 o'clock in the morning, some of these young men were attempting to get out of that segment of the city, and they crossed the freeway on foot, and one of them got clipped by a car at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was very tragic. He was killed immediately. He was actually thrown partially through the windshield, and it injured the driver of the car. And of course, the driver of the car had no choice. He's going down the freeway, you know, doing the speed limit, probably 65 miles an hour. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's a pedestrian in front of him, and he can't swerve. There's nowhere for him to go. So he ended up hitting the guy. Very tragic. It's not like the driver would choose to do this. No driver, you know, drives down the freeway at 3 o'clock in the morning hoping to hit somebody. That's just not a realistic scenario. So the driver was entirely not at fault. The pedestrians, though stupid and possibly alcohol influenced that they were acting, oddly enough, in a way that could be predicted, that could be entirely predicted, because you've placed something enticing in the middle of the section. You have placed restrictions on drunk driving so that they dare not drive drunk. You've created a series of laws regarding taxis and so forth that make taxis so expensive, and it's a guild to try to get into it and start the new business. So you have price controls in that, and it makes it so expensive that your average lower level worker can't afford a taxi. And then you put all this enticing stuff right in the middle of this freeway with housing, major housing, including low-income apartments on the outside of that freeway. Why? And so you've created, the state itself has created a scenario which forces people who might be going into that, to where those bars are and where those strip clubs are and so forth, you've created a scenario that practically forces them to cross that freeway on foot. And then, tragically, every now and then, this happens. Somebody clips a pedestrian in the middle of the night. Okay, so then the police show up, and the fire department, and the ambulance, and they all are doing their jobs. And the statist will say, see, we have to have the state, otherwise who would go up there, who would go out there at 3 o'clock in the morning and clean up this mess and correct this horrible situation? Well, first off, the state created the situation. If this were private businesses putting in the freeways, they would have an incentive to put walkways underneath and charge very small amounts that they could make up for the quantity through, you know, they would make up through the small amounts that they charge through the quantity of people that used their passageways. So if it was purely capitalist, there would be a capitalist incentive to put through walkways under the freeway that people could use and pay for. Or there would be advertisers, or there would be some other way to pay for putting these walkways under. But since we have the state, we don't have that. The market cannot function in that capacity. So we have a situation the state has created to begin with. Then the police show up. Now, the ambulance got there right away. The ambulance personnel got the injured people out of there very quickly. The fire department made sure that nothing was, you know, going to blow up. They kept the place stable. They did their job very quickly. The police, on the other hand, have a death to investigate. So they rope off this whole section of the freeway from 3 o'clock in the morning until about 9. That pushes it past the morning rush hour. That means all the traffic that used to go northbound on that particular freeway, which is a main artery leading into the city of Dayton, all of that traffic, all the northbound traffic on one of the nation's busiest highways, by the way, now gets diverted down a side road that is mostly two-lane and is not made for that kind of capacity. There are stoplights, there are pedestrians, there are businesses on each side, and now you've got big trucks rolling down through there trying to get, you know, from Florida to Michigan or whatever, and they're forced taking this side road on the northern path, trying to go around this detour that the police have created. So now, of course, that's not the police's fault, right? Well, I don't know. What's so difficult to figure out here? You have pedestrians crossing where they're not supposed to be crossing in the middle of the night. It's clearly not the driver's fault. Case closed. Turn the driver loose as soon as he's out of the hospital. So then the next question, was the victim running across the highway of his own accord, or was he being chased or forced in some way? Well, that shouldn't be too hard to figure out. And you can figure it out without blocking the entire freeway for hours at a time. So why would the police want to block the freeway for hours at a time? Why would they go out there and take their time and take photographs of the skid marks and walk around and do all this stuff for hours rather than just take the pedestrians down to the police station and question them and make a determination if aggression was used or if they were just being drunk and stupid? What's the difference? Well, guess what? All those cops are on overtime. And if they have a choice of, let's see, we'll go all of us cops together, all 8 or 10 of us or whatever it took, and we'll stand around out here and we'll chit chat and the weather's pretty good, so it's a good time to do this, and we'll stand around and we'll do this nice and slow at a leisurely pace, and we'll get paid overtime and we don't have to go and clean up other accidents or go to domestic disputes or go to other situations that could be dangerous or could be nasty or could be boring. We don't have to go and sit on a corner somewhere radaring. We don't have to do any of those things. We can stay right out here and take as long as we want to clean up this mess. And what motivation do we have to hurry? We have no motivation to hurry. As a matter of fact, if we can stay out here and plug up this major highway for the next few hours, then when it comes budget time, we can tell the city, you see, there were 4 more accidents on that other highway in the time that we had the freeway plugged. That's why we need a bigger budget. That's why we need more cops hired in this particular district. You see, so the cops, whether they think about it or consciously or not, is not the point. There is an incentive. And people react to incentives whether they realize or whether they think about the incentive or not. They still react to incentives. So in that particular scenario, there were a number of incentives to motivate the cops to take their time and slowly investigate this most obvious tragedy. And because of that, you have the potential for other accidents and other deaths. But you see, the people, the cops involved, are insulated from any punishment from that because they're just doing their job. They're doing their job exactly like they're told, exactly like they're trained. They're being efficient. Oh, we can't cut corners. You see, you can't take chances. You can't be too safe. All those phrases, all those empty selling points, all of those are used to justify. And yet, what would it be like without them? Well, if there was an actual incentive to get a job done within a... Well, here's an example. Not long ago, a couple years ago, a storm came through, took the roof off my house. Now, I shopped around a bit, and I found a guy who was willing to take the job of re-roofing my house for me within the price range that I was looking for. And he came out, and he brought six guys in his crew. And they stormed my roof, and they were on my roof like ants, just going in every direction. And they arrived at my house, if I recall, about 9 or 9:30, they arrived at my house. And my house is not small. It's not huge, but it's not small. And they completely re-roofed my house and my garage and were done and had the whole yard cleaned up, took magnets on rollers and walked around my yard, cleaned up everything, including the landscaping, everything before 5 o'clock that afternoon. Now, how could they get a job like that done in that kind of time frame? Here's how. Because I could have hired the other roofing company. I could have hired a roofing company that would take 2 days. But I didn't. I hired them because I didn't want people in my yard and on my roof for 2 days. And they had the reputation. They could do this job, they could do it fast, and they could do it within the budget. Now, don't you think we could have cops that could do the same thing? Aren't there private security right now, today, who can offer that kind of thing to individuals? Whether you're some famous star, or whether you're some important delegate, or whether you're some important person of some kind and you have money, and you say, I need to make sure that I have security to get me from point A to point B. Aren't there companies today that you can rely on that can do that for you? And honestly now, who would you rather have as your security? Your average small town cop or your average professional who actually does security for a living? Well, if money's not a problem, I think it's pretty obvious you hire professional security. But then again, the cop's charging you 70% of your wages. So really, who's more expensive? Just like in the situation with the roofing, the more expensive one is not necessarily the best. The best is the one that you choose that fits your needs. And that's what we would have in an anarcho-capitalist system. We would have competing police officers, competing highway builders, competing for the best. We wouldn't have highway builders who can simply bribe a politician and then build a highway that'll only last for a few years and then work constant construction on that highway, keeping it maintained, and then have to rebuild it every few years because the design is not even built in a way, is not even planned in a way that's going to cause it to exist for very long. Planned obsolescence on highways in the United States today guarantees that we're going to have perpetual companies out there perpetually working on replacing major sections of the highway. They never finish. Why? Because if they built a good highway, they wouldn't have to go out and repair it constantly. So they take a little bit of their money, they give it a little bit to their politicians, and the politicians make sure that the same process continues. And that's who your faith is in. That's who your faith is in, rather than believing that the market could provide people who would build a road that would be permanent, that wouldn't need constant repair, that people could get from one side to the other safely on it. And if somebody designed something wrong in a highway and there was a flaw in it, then the designer of that highway could be held responsible. Okay, I've run over my time there. I should have already broke from my commercial. Stick with me. When I come back from that commercial, we'll pick back up on this. And the commercial's very brief, and really, give it a listen. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from BadQuaker.com. Thanks, folks. Thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. That wasn't really so bad, now was it? Okay, and by the way, sometime this week I'll try to record a new commercial, so you won't have to hear the same boring one over and over, or the same boring two. Now, I wanted to shift gears a little bit. Let's talk about something Franz Oppenheimer... He argued that there were two fundamentally opposed processes. There was what he called the political means, that is through aggression, deception, and coercion, or there was the economic means, that is through peaceful voluntary exchange. Now, as you begin to examine these two processes, you begin to realize that there is no third option. Any involvement, any human, pretty much all human relations fall into one of these two categories, either the political means or the economic means. Now, Franz Oppenheimer was talking specifically about obtaining wealth, but really you can shift it around and say the same is true about power, the same is true about influence, the same is true about social position. Pretty much any time that humans interact, they interact in one of these two ways, the political means that he describes or the economic means. So then if we examine these two, the political means would include things like theft, fraud, coercion, and it would also include bribes and favors that result in theft, fraud, or coercion. Now, people who regularly use the political means would include, say, abusive parents, abusive spouses, crime gangs, like the mafia, common thieves would be included, lobbyists, we put them right in there with common thieves, although they wear much better suits generally, fractional reserve bankers, corporations, the mainstream media, and, of course, politicians use the political means. So there are really just the two forces. There's the state, which utilizes the political means, and there's the market, which utilizes voluntary means. So let's think about the state and the market for a minute. The market is a voluntary exchange of thoughts, ideas, goods, and services, whereas the state relies entirely upon aggression. The state and the market can't function in the same place at the same time, as the existence of each destroys the other. Now let's think about some examples of that for just for fun. Let's say a market exists. There are people peaceably exchanging. Let's say they're peaceably exchanging goods. One person, well, I like to use the apples. Let's go with apples. One person is selling apples. The other person is selling tacos. They have agreed on a medium of exchange. They're going to use seashells as a medium of exchange. So using this standard, the apple vendor and the taco vendor and all the merchants and all the buyers and all the sellers in the marketplace can function peaceably. They all agree to each and every exchange because if they don't agree, it's not voluntary and they don't exchange. So it's that simple. Now, in a situation like that, the moment that you introduce fraud or theft, coercion, aggression of any kind, the minute that you introduce aggression, the market ceases to be. It's no longer a market. It's now you are exchanging using a method that is not the market. So, for example, someone comes up, the market is flowing along just fine, everybody's exchanging peaceably, and someone walks up and sticks a gun in front of the taco vendor's face and says, "Give me all your seashells and two tacos to go." That's not a voluntary exchange. That's not peaceful voluntary exchange. The market has been interrupted. The market does not exist in that exchange. The violence, the aggression of the robber has destroyed the possibility that there is a market there. Now, it goes the other way as well. Let's say someone is accustomed to robbing and stealing for their tacos, and so they go into the market. They go into the area where the market is taking place. And as he approaches the taco vendor and he draws his gun and he has the taco vendor, he has the drop on the taco vendor, the apple vendor realizes, hey, the taco vendor is getting robbed. So because we humans tend to cooperate, the apple vendor shoots the thief in the head, killing him, freeing the taco vendor of the robbery. Guess what? The market just interrupted the political means. Isn't that wonderful? In other words, in a free exchange, in a voluntary Free as in voluntary, not free as in without cost. But in a voluntary exchange, the Apple vendor has provided a service for the taco vendor. The market has eliminated the possibility of the political means functioning. And if you really analyze any type of exchange between human beings, if it is a market exchange, it can be interrupted if the political means shows up. And if the political means is taking place, it can be interrupted by peaceful voluntary exchange, because self-defense is a peaceful voluntary exchange. And so if the taco vendor had been able to draw his gun and shoot the thief, then that would have been self-defense. But in the case of the Apple vendor, the Apple vendor is voluntarily providing that self-defense for his friend, the taco vendor. They may not even be friends. They may not like each other at all, or they may see each other as competitors. But any Apple vendor with any intelligence would realize that if the thief today will rob the taco vendor, then the thief on a different day may well rob the Apple vendor. So in a desire, again, for peaceful exchange, there is always a method that the market can find to provide all the products and services that the market requires. But you cannot have both the market and the state being aggression. They can't exist in the same place at the same time. Now you make the argument, well, of course, the thief was not the state. No, the thief was not the state. But then let's think about who uses the political means. The political means are used by an abusive parent, an abusive spouse, crime gangs like the mafia, common thieves, lobbyists, fractional reserve bankers, corporations, the mainstream media, and politicians. Now, why is it we don't just whip out a pistol and shoot these people when we see them doing what it is that they do, when we see them using the political means to live off of the rest of society? Why don't we just whip out a pistol and shoot these people? Well, there's one reason we don't. That's the myth of the state. Because people believe that when these people, only choice ones of them, by the way, not everybody is allowed to act this way. Only within the mythology of the state, only a very choice group of people that are in the club are allowed to act this way. Anybody who's not in the club being those who work for the government or are part of the government and therefore control that monopoly of violence, and they utilize the myth of the state in order to secure their position and to cause in the case of the Apple vendor and the taco vendor, when the robbery takes place, if the Apple vendor believes that the thief is acting on behalf of the state, if he believes that, and he sees that the thief, in fact, is a government employee, then for some reason, because of this myth of the state, he looks over it and he says, oh, well, that's how it has to be. There must be something there I don't know about. Or, well, I'll bet that taco vendor, you know, must be guilty of a crime. Because of the myth of the state, there's an assumption that the actor utilizing the political means is doing okay. He's doing what he should be doing because of the belief in the state. So if you have a situation where the Apple vendor sees the aggressor, does nothing about the aggressor, and the taco vendor is then robbed, you don't have a market. The political means has interrupted the market. You can't get the market back unless you remove the political means. There is no peaceable exchange between them that involves mutual protection. So because you've introduced the thief who is utilizing the political means, and because you've introduced the myth of the state that prevents the market from correcting that situation, then you've destroyed the possibility of there being a market there. The market can no longer exist. So now, you might think that I'm throwing the net kind of wide when I'm including all these different people as using the political means. But really, if you break it down and think of each one, the abusive parent is using coercion or physical abuse or whatever processes to maintain a power structure within a family. The abusive spouse or abusive partner in a relationship is doing the same thing. They're possibly using coercion, or they're using fraud, or in some cases, actual violence in order to maintain a position of power in a relationship. The only thing that keeps those from actually being the state is that we don't believe that those are acceptable. Although, on the other hand, when a government does this with another government, or when a government does this to individuals, then we think it's okay because we believe in the state. So, for example, if I say, there's a place north from here where I'd really like to go and maybe do some fishing. Well, the government says you can't do that because in order to go to that place that's north of you, you have to cross our magic line that we've drawn, and you have to go into the realm of another government. You have to go into Canada. All right. And I say, well, I would like to go up there and go fishing, and so I'm just going to go. But the problem is, as I start to go into Canada to go and fish, there are gentlemen there with funny uniforms, with these weird costumes on, and somehow they believe they have authority. And this belief is because of the state. And so the government, through these people, these clown-like people who believe that this authority is real, they will use this aggression upon me in the name of the government. They will use this aggression on me to try to force me to recognize their authority and behave in the way that they would want me to behave, which is showing my papers and allowing them to search my person or my property. All these things that would in every other way not be an acceptable situation. This is allowed through this relationship with the government because of this belief in the state. So in that sense, the politicians that maintain their position in government are exactly like the abusive partner in a relationship that uses aggression and uses coercion and uses lies and deception in order to keep another person bound in a relationship. Well, a government will do the same thing in order to keep one person within their jurisdiction, or to maintain, to control the behavior of one person in any particular setting, so that they perpetuate this myth that they somehow have this authority over them. And if they need to put you in a jail for that to accomplish that, or if they just need to, send a man in a uniform to rough you up, or to, take something that you might own, by the form of a taxation or a fine or whatever means, the effect is the same. The only difference between the abusive partner in the relationship and the abusive partner in the relationship being the government is that the government has the magic anointing of the state. So then when we think about the state, and we think and we realize that these current governments that utilize the aggression and this mythology of the state, these current governments, the problem becomes, so what do we do about them? How can we function with the aggression, with the political means being used all around us? How can we find that market again? How can we go back to functioning in the market if we're surrounded in every way by individuals who believe in the state, and they utilize the aggression of government to inflict the state upon us, to push the political means upon us in every direction? How can we ever get back to that market again? And of course, the way that we have to do that is by just doing it. It's not by attacking the government itself. If let's go back to the Apple and the taco vendor. Let's say there's not one guy there with a gun robbing the Apple vendor. Let's say there are thousands of people around. And of those thousands, the vast majority of them believe the guy with the gun has the right to rob the taco vendor because the guy with the gun has a uniform. And all the other people around believe that. Well, then if the Apple vendor whips out his pistol and shoots the robber, then he's going to have a very large problem on his hands with all the rest of those people who believe the mythology of the state and believed that the thief who was robbing the taco vendor actually was doing right as he was doing that. So what's the smart thing for the Apple vendor and the taco vendor to do? Well, of course, the market is gone in their exchange. As long as the thief can find them, as long as the thief knows where they are and what they're doing and can interrupt it, as long as the thief has that knowledge, the thief in this case being the government, as long as the thief has that knowledge, then he can always come and interrupt it as long as people believe in the state. So what do the vendors have to do? They have to find a way to have their peaceful exchange, to have their economic means. And they have to do it without the knowledge of people who believe in the state. In other words, it has to be a black market. It has to be a hidden market, a secret market, a left-handed market. The agora, whatever terminology that you want to use, that is the only way that we can have a real, peaceful, voluntary exchange utilizing the economic means. That's the only place the market exists, is where the state, where those people who believe in the state don't know that it exists. So let's give our taco vendor, let's give him a truck. And let's give our Apple vendor a truck. So now we have an Apple vendor who has a mobile truck, and we have a taco vendor who has a mobile truck. Now they can move around, and they don't have the permission of anybody in government. They're moving around, selling their tacos, selling their apples where they can, and they're not asking anybody's permission. They're not getting special government licensing, and not, they're working completely through economic means. Their only way that they can do that is to continue in an invisible fashion to the rest of those people who believe in the state. They can be right among them. They can be selling tacos and apples right to those statists who believe in the state. They just have to do it in a way that doesn't make it obvious of what they're doing. It's secret, so that those believing in the political means can't interrupt the market. Now, so this begs the question, well, what about working within the system? What about, let's say, going down and getting your vendor's license and just doing that so that you don't have to deal with it? Well, that might be the best, because here's the thing of it. To go ahead and run your taco wagon, taking the risk of getting caught, that's great, except If you can pull it off quietly and without the state finding out about it, then you'll do well. But you have to weigh the options. What happens if I get caught? Can I extract myself from this situation? Will I be able to pay all the fines and bribes and all the nonsense that goes with getting caught? And if you are willing to do this, or if you see this as a possible way that you can protest the state, protest the unfairness of the political means, well, this is something you have to weigh for yourself. However, keep this in mind whenever you, any time that you've come to the conclusion that you are in fact going to protest something. Really, protests only serve one purpose, and that's to outreach to other victims of the state. When other victims of the state see the abuse that we take at the hands of the state, and they can relate to that abuse, then sometimes they can be brought over to our side and see that, in fact, the state is wrong and the state is a myth, and they can begin to accept the economic means and reject the political means. That's the only legitimate purpose for a protest, is for outreach. a protest hoping to change the mind of the statists into accepting a particular thing. So for instance, if you're protesting, say, your right to drink raw milk, or you're protesting your right to possess a gun, and you're doing so for the purpose of trying to get permission from your master, then you're missing the whole point. The protest can only serve as an outreach to other victims. If your master gives you the permission to carry a gun or drink raw milk or sell tacos or sell apples, then you're still a slave and you're still working under the political means and you're part of the problem. You're believing in the state. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you.